Log Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Midrash, where the Navy Millblog community's top bloggers discuss the latest developments, long-term trends, and the way forward for the Navy Marine Corps team and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. As a quick reminder to those who are joining us live, make sure and join the chat room at the bottom of the show page with the usual suspects. If you have some observations or some comments about our discussions today, bring them in the chat room. Eagle One will be riding herd on it, and we'll pick it up and try to fold it into our conversation as best as we can. And if you're new to Midrats and you want to catch up on some of our previous shows you might find interesting, you can always get the full show archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can do the low-tech, low-maintenance way and just set up yourself for the podcast on iTunes. Now let's get on with the show. We're going to focus today on what may be the implications or the change in some of the emphasis on national security issues as a result of the 2010 election, or between now and that Tuesday in November, some issues we may see come to the front. And we're going to do that with the same pair of guests that we had back in May to discuss the same topic. We're going to have Mackenzie Eaglin from the Heritage Foundation, where she is a research fellow on national security. And we're also going to have in the second half of the hour James S. Robbins. He's a senior editorial writer for foreign affairs at the Washington Times. And we're going to just go straight into our first guest, Mackenzie Eaglin. In addition to her position at Heritage, where she specializes in subjects such as defense strategy, military readiness, and the defense budget, she also has extensive experience on Capitol Hill, the Pentagon, and her commentaries have appeared in major newspapers, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the military-focused publications such as the Armed Forces Journal, Defense News, Army Times, and magazines of the National Defense and Military Technology. Her paper, A New Look at Readiness, Solving the Army's Quandary, was taught at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Mackenzie, welcome back to Midrats.
Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Great. And thanks for coming back. We really enjoyed your visit on Midrats back in May. And as we've come out the summer tunnel, I think if you're looking at the politics coming up to the election, the big story everywhere has been, for lack of a better phrase, the Tea Party movement and the wave that we've seen at the right side and libertarian side of the political equations with a lot of the candidates that come up. And one thing I've been trying to get my hands around on what would be a primary or a secondary effect of that is what are their views on national security issues that they may bring to the table if they get elected in numbers. But probably even more than that is because they're junior, whatever issues they bring, the impact will be mitigated to a certain extent because what really counts in those organizations is seniority. So as they come in and vote, if the Republicans take the House or the Senate, you're going to have a change in the power structure and leadership. And I think that would probably be where their big impacts would have. Where do you think we might see a change in conversation or focus on some of the external issues that our nation faces after 2010?
Well, I think you're right. We are in the heat of election season right now. It always kicks off in earnest after Labor Day. And, you know, all the way leading up to the Delaware primary win this week with Christine O'Donnell, I think the Tea Party impact writ large on the candidates they're pulling in for the general elections, it's really an open question on national security issues and foreign policy and defense specifically. It's really the big question mark. You know, we know some candidates, like in Kentucky, some Tea Party candidates, you know, have, as you mentioned, tend to have a strong libertarian strain. And, you know, years and years ago, that was still pretty much in line with sort of a general conservative policy of peace through strength and robust defense. But, you know, in the last 10, 20, 30 years, there's been some splits within the conservative big tent, so to speak. And, you know, there are a lot of different philosophies among conservatives these days about what a strong defense entails or if it's even important, whereas I'd argue it used to be a central pillar of conservatism, that you were always for a strong defense, you know, and a robust military, that sort of thing, no matter what. But I'd argue that that's in question in general as part of conservatives in the larger conservative movement, and then take it a step further with the Tea Parties, it certainly is there. You could foreseeably have a few candidates, you know, be co-opted by the left to jump on the, you know, cut defense budget bandwagon because a major focus of the Tea Parties, as you guys know, is the debt, small government, anti-deficit, you know, reduce the debt platform. And it's very easy to then quickly just bleed over and say, well, you know, defense should be on the table as, you know, as one of these items. But I think there's hope. I think the Tea Parties, because in some ways their candidates are somewhat of a blank slate on defense, it actually could work out where it could be a positive thing that they could, you know, sort of restart a movement within the conservative circles among the, quote, establishment, that a strong defense needs to become a front burner issue again because it's the constitutional duty of government. In fact, as you guys know, it is the purpose of government. Everything else the government provides and does, infrastructure and everything else, that's nice, but as the three of us know and all of your listeners, none of that matters if our defense falls away or if our national security is in jeopardy. And I think that we need a conversation about this, and hopefully the Tea Parties can start this as opposed to end it with a call to cut defense, because we're going to see more of that come December when the president's deficit commission, comes out, I fear.
Well, that raises an issue that kind of on the periphery, but I'm sort of wondering where this leads in the greater scheme of things. There have been a lot of discussions about the expenses of having the military retirees and how lucrative, in some people's eyes, the military retirement program is. Is that a stalking horse for doing, in your view, and doing away with other benefits, or is it only the military that's going to get tagged with this? And in the scheme of financial thing, is that something that you'd view the Republicans, the Tea Parties are trying to reverse, or is that just part of the greater scheme of saving money in the government?
Well, it's interesting. You know, that's a great question because it's the third rail of defense politics, our benefits. And I mean, you know, when you look at the military compensation pie chart, you know, those in uniform are paid over half in deferred and in-kind benefits, and then about 48-49% of that is cash. You know, their pay stub, their take-home pay. And, you know, it's very expensive to the government, those deferred and in-kind benefits, as you might imagine. But, you know, there's also this understanding that they're expensive for a reason. We have an all-volunteer force, and you have to pay them at a professional salary, and that includes over-competitive benefits, I would argue. But at the same time, 4 out of 5 people in the military don't serve 20 years, and so the cost to the government is quite high, and you picked on a key theme, which is the cost of retirees. What we're seeing in the Great Recession happen are a lot of employers and employees in private sector jobs who also have, you know, military retirement and healthcare benefits, dumping their employer plans and coming back into TRICARE. And, you know, it's basically, you know, turning into the Ponzi scheme similar to the big three entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, where we're really not generating enough to pay for it based on, you know, expected defense budgets, et cetera. And it's a part of a larger conversation, I think, that, you know, frankly, the building needs to have, meaning the Pentagon and military leaders, because I can start that conversation on the outside, but I don't think it's going to be useful on the outside to do that unless it comes from within. What's interesting about the Secretary of Defense and all of his recent budget cuts, you know, last year it started with 50 major weapons programs worth $300 billion, and then this year, as you guys know, he just moved on to these efficiency cuts, but the one area he is not examining are military benefits.
And, Mackenzie, that subject, it brings a smile to my face in an interesting way, in that we had the MILBLOG conference in one of the earlier this spring, and one of the sessions that they had had some personnel experts up there, and I took a twisted joy in having the one question that wasn't answered, in that, you know, when you look at military personnel costs, and I think Eagle One, and you hit exactly on what the touchy issue is, all you have to do is read the MOAA magazine to see is the retirement benefits. And if you wanted to benchmark, really the only comparable military is 2 hours. Those are the Western Europeans. And you look at how they model their military retirement system. You don't walk out at 20 years and get 35% of your base pay to 50% of your base pay. You wait until you're 55 or later. And it's a very, very, very different program. And I think you're right that for this conversation to take place, I don't think it can start in Congress. It has to start in the Pentagon. And I really haven't seen, outside of Secretary Gates, anybody else willing to jump into that fray. Do you see some of the, if not political appointees, some of the senior civilian people in the Pentagon that have done some work on what are options A, B, and C that would be less retirement benefits, but something that is more in line with what the Europeans do with theirs?
You know, this summer I spent a lot of time, I was a staff member to the QDR Independent Panel. And as you know, it's something I championed last year at Heritage, and Congress went along, and which was great, actually. We're a conservative think tank and a Democratic Congress. I mean, we all reach across the aisle here, and it was fantastic. And Congress stood up this group of 20 senior, you know, graybeards, so to speak, chaired by William Perry, Clinton's Secretary of Defense, and Steve Hadley, George Bush's National Security Advisor. And actually, the panel leaned Democrat. There were 12 liberals and 8 conservatives on the panel, and they issued a very striking bipartisan consensus report that said the health of the all-volunteer force is in question right now. As you guys both know, the grand experiment is still underway. We have never asked the all-volunteer force since its inception in 1973 to do what we've asked it to do, which is 10 years of continuous warfare, and nobody knows how much longer we can sustain that. And what we did was stress test the all-volunteer force as part of our review, and we had access and great cooperation from the Pentagon for data. And basically looking at everything from each type of benefit to how many people are accepting them to...
Mackenzie?
I think she fell off.
She did fall off. What I'll do, Eagle One, why don't you give us a monologue on the joys of having the orange bug juice versus the red bug juice. I'm going to hop offline and give her, see if I can call her right back.
Well, I don't know about the orange and the red. I just know the stories that my sailors used to tell me about the green bug juice. Don't drink it before you go into port, is what they said. I didn't mean to raise, when I started this, I didn't really mean to raise a question that would be as narrow as it was, but the other side of this issue is has to do with the medical benefits, and part of that, if we get Mackenzie back, is whether or not there's going to be an attempt to force the military out of TRICARE into a different national program, arguing that TRICARE is not necessary given the national health care program. And as far as that, yes, Ken, green is best for Ashikwadish of teak decks. It's all that saltpeter in, I think.
Two. And we have Mackenzie back. I think we lost you about halfway through a sentence there. Mackenzie, you back? Well, you know, it helps if I... Yeah, it was about... Now, that time it was my fault because I didn't hit the mute button. Mackenzie, we have you back.
Oh, good. Hello. Sorry about that.
That's okay. It's the ones and zeros of technology.
So what was I saying? I know I was going off.
Well, actually, since you left, I posed a question that you couldn't have heard, but I'll ask it again anyway. Is part of what you see with the, Democrats are doing, or what with the national health care, will there be an effort to force the military out of their own health care plan into some kind of national health care system to save money?
Earlier this year when Congress was debating, the Obamacare health care bill, this actually was the one area Congress immediately said the military is going to be exempt from this discussion, more or less speaking. And, that probably could have been a good time to start a conversation about, the future of military health care, which is one of the largest cost drivers, frankly, of, military compensation. And honestly, not that it necessarily needs to be cut, but it probably could use a little updating and reform. But, Congress was not willing to do that. And I know you just said earlier that it probably can't start on the Hill, and I completely agree. I was at a meeting with Secretary Gates after he gave his efficiency press briefing, and he had a meeting with select think tankers afterwards, a private meeting. And I raised the personnel compensation issue with him. And I wasn't even talking about the TRICARE benefit copayment increases, because that's a small sort of sum of money. I just said this larger conversation about how we pay America's military, and if we couldn't make it more competitive for a highly mobile 21st century workforce. And he basically looked at me and said, Mackenzie, we cannot even begin to have that conversation while men and women are still in Afghanistan. And that, unfortunately, I think is where we are today, although those inside the building recognize that this is a conversation we have to have, because the defense budget is so internally imbalanced and skewed towards personnel. And what you got to do is you got to do everything good in the Pentagon budget. You have to pay your people well, who are a professional all-volunteer force, and you have to give them all of the next-generation equipment that they need. And right now we're doing one at the expense of the other.
Yeah, that's a shame to hear that, because, you're exactly right. It's an issue that is not getting better by the day, and it's the equivalent of having a car and saying, I don't have time to change the oil because I got to keep my wheels balanced. You've got to find a way to really do one to keep it working well. And we're talking about the efficiency review. I know I was very glad to hear it, and I know a lot of the readers over my home blog were as well. When SecDef Gates came out and, he pulled the low-hanging fruit, which was Joint Forces Command, and said, hey, here's a way that we can save some billets and save some money. And, of course, then you had the wailing coming from the Virginia delegation. But when you look at, in the last 15 years, the level of staff bloat, or in the Navy, one of the ratios we use is admirals to warships, the graph is just, for lack of a better word, obscene. And there's ways to grab hold of that. And probably one of the most efficient ways would be, because with every flag officer or every SES that you have, there is a backdraft with that person, whether it's a staff that they need to be in charge of or their personal staff, that if you could make an effort to cull the number of flag officer billets and SES billets, that you could start to perhaps nibble around at the edges. Do you see much of an appetite of moving from talking about it to actually going down billets and commands and doing some consolidation? And no kidding, bottom line cuts, as opposed to moving billets from one UIC to another.
Well, I'm with you. I sure do hope so. But the funny thing is, people think weapon systems are so hard to kill. They're actually a lot easier to kill than these types of efficiency and overhead bureaucracy reforms that the Secretary is taking under. They're fuzzy, they're difficult, they're easy, political targets, and it's hard to generate savings. But, this is really an area the Navy, as you mentioned, in particular, has been hit very hard post 9/11. My work on the QDR independent panel this summer, we met with all the chiefs, and the CNO told us about the explosion in overhead, particularly in the last 5 years. And it's not just sort of the SES flag and general officer billets and the growth therein, but it's also the Navy's contribution to overhead and joint billets. So, for example, combatant commands, whose appetite for personnel is insatiable. Combatant commands, defense agencies, like DISA and DITRA and all these other places, and then joint task forces. When was the last time you ever heard of a task force stand up that eventually stood down? You know, and so the Navy's contribution to these has gone up something like 52% in the last 4 years, and they never get those people back, and they also don't get any money or end strength in return on the back end. And you guys remember in 05, the Navy and the Air Force had to cut end strength levels to simply tread water on their personnel bills, which is how fast personnel costs are rising. So, you know, I really see this sort of culture of the Pentagon of people as a free commodity in general. And this is part of that conversation, and they're just going to have, it has to change because it circles all the way back because of the cost of people. You need to make sure what you're asking that person in uniform to do every day is exactly what you expect and not some bureaucratic position where someone else could potentially fill that job or someone at a lower level. And so, you know, the Navy knows that this is important. And, you know, what I am seeing, though, as you might expect in D.C., is just a general resistance. You know, I picked up on a lot of uniform anger to the 50 billets for the flag general officer cuts, and I was surprised by that, actually. And, you know, it could just be an inside the beltway reaction. I don't know what it is outside, but, you know, these are the uncomfortable conversations and cuts that we have to start talking about because, really, let's be honest, there aren't that many modernization programs left to kill. There just aren't enough weapon systems programs left on the table that you can, you know, the major programs that can be cut to generate savings anymore. We have to talk about things in O&M, overhead, and personnel.
I think you hit on something, Mackenzie, there. In my opinion, from my point of view in the hinterlands, when it comes to resistance to cutting flag officer and general officer billets, it is a beltway item. When you get down into the fleet, you talk to the bull captains and the bull colonels and below who don't have a dog in a fight. They will. I did it when I was in Afghanistan with a Marine Corps colonel. They can sit down there and give you a 2-hour dissertation about how you can do exactly what you talked about. Do you really need a 2-star doing this job, or can you have a captain or colonel with 28 years do this job? And just can break it out from there. So it's definitely a conversation that needs to be had, but if you want to get two sides of the table talking, maybe bring in some people who haven't been to D.C. in a few years. Eagle One.
Well, I'm also have a question about the as Obama may or may not lose his majority in the Houses of Congress, is someone going to raise these issues of the inefficiencies, you know, identified in the Belisle report and the reports, recent GAO report on the littoral combat ship, and say, you know, what the heck are you guys doing with the money we do give you? Where are we going to head with that, depending on who gets elected at the next level?
Well, it's interesting. You know, Congress is definitely moving into the space of open to the idea of an overall top line defense cut, which I think is a little frightening because, you know, If you ping the guys on the front line, the sailors, you know, deployed, I'll bet you they would all tell you every year they've been in service, they've been asked to do more with less. And, you know, we're only seeing more of that come along. When you look at the cost of everything in the department, you know, yes, you can trim some fat here and there. There, you know, the fraud, waste, abuse argument, the overhead in particular that we just talked about. But at the end of the day, the defense budget today, I'd argue, is the bare minimum that we can, you know, we can't really go below today's levels. And that's Gates' point about these efficiency cuts. You know, the reason he told us in the Pentagon, he started this latest move on to find $100 billion in savings in overhead to reinvest it into modernization programs, meaning, you know, the replacement of equipment with next-generation platforms. He said it's because he notices a shifting political climate, and GOP members, Republicans, are saying defense can be cut now. And this is full circle to the Tea Party issue that we talked about earlier. You know, it's fascinating that so many members are concerned about the debt and the deficit, and so defense is becoming, you know, more amenable to this part of this conversation of how do we pay that down. Of course, you know, we all know defense is not the source of the federal government's fiscal woes by any means. It's only about 18% of the entire federal budget. And for what we ask the military to do, I'd argue that's a bargain. It's less than 4% of our whole economy. So, you know, but the concern here is that there's going to be a growing conversation on the Hill about cutting defense. And not necessarily so much as, you know, sort of the LCS or other things, but just in general, defense needs to be a bill payer, you know, as part of this conversation. And that's what worries me. I'd much rather than take a scalpel to LCS or to the decision to grow the acquisition workforce. Is that the right thing or the wrong thing? Is NAVC too big when you're only building 6 or 7 shifts a year? I much prefer that conversation. I'm comfortable with those types of potential cuts, but not the larger top line cut.
Well, if you were forced to make cuts in the DOD to pay for underfunded programs like the maintenance of the Aegis-class cruisers, which we're going to rely on apparently for ballistic missile defense, what would you cut?
You know, I've talked a lot about this actually and given it a lot of thought. You know, the Pentagon should never be able to rest on its laurels because it is a $500 billion annual.
That's Salamander having fun calling our next guest.
Oh, sorry. It's a $500 billion annual budget, so, you know, it certainly needs to be part of the cut conversation, but I think you can find internal efficiencies. For example, you know, the Aerospace Industries Association has talked a lot about performance-based logistics, basically the maintenance of a weapon system over its life cycle where the real costs come in. You know, building the LCS, for example, is expensive, but maintaining it is the most expensive part of that overall bill to the military. And you can do that differently with public-private partnerships, and it actually ends up saving you money. I won't get into it here. But then the other piece of this, of course, is, you know, we have to talk about compensation. And it doesn't mean cuts. It means paying the military differently. You know, 4 out of 5 people in the military don't serve 20 years, and they're a highly mobile young workforce. They probably want more cash up front and don't put as much value on those deferred and in-kind benefits. So the Uncle Sam could possibly take some of that money back, give them more cash, and ultimately save some in the long run. I have a whole host of ideas actually at heritage.org as well, additional ones.
Okay. Well, what is the, I mean, we talk about the cost of the Defense Department, but doesn't that also feed back into the economy? What's the impact on the economy of developing new ships, buying new aircraft, getting new air, you know, tankers and all the other stuff that's going on?
Oh, my goodness. You know, it's so funny with all of the stimulus and bailouts, and I'm not picking on any person or party here, but with all the stimulus and bailout talks, the one sector that never, ever came up is America's defense manufacturing industrial base, which is primarily shipbuilding and aerospace, as you guys know. I mean, beyond automotives, that really is what America's manufacturing industrial base is, shipbuilding and aerospace. And yet, remarkably, no push has been made in the White House or on Capitol Hill to stimulate that as part of the economy. And, you know, we did this after World War II and actually during. And it works. And frankly, the thing is, it wouldn't be a jobs program because the Pentagon needs to recapitalize its shipbuilding fleet. I mean, I would argue there's a great need there to not only bolster the numbers, but as we've briefly touched on here, the maintenance and everything else. But, you know, next generation ships, everybody knows the shipbuilding budget's underfunded and that building 6 or 7 ships a year will never get us to 313 at this rate. You know, there's a legitimate need there, and I wish it would be more of a conversation. These are highly skilled professionals, as you guys know, designers and engineers, building some of the most advanced, capable, you know, technologically capable systems in the world. And they could use some more work because once you lose that workforce, as you know, they're gone forever. And we're seeing that in shipbuilding today. You know, Northrop Grumman's talking about spinning off Pascagoula. This is really has major implications for, frankly, Navy budgets in the future. If you take away competition for major surface combatants, for example, for destroyers, which you would if Ingalls were sold, and you give Bath Iron Works, you know, is sold basically the sole contract award by default, you know, that's not necessarily the healthiest establishment for the government and the taxpayer dollar behind it. You know, it's a good thing to maintain the workforce and the industrial base. It promotes competition, but there also is that just economic element of engineering the economy.
And as we come near the bottom of the hour, you know, we touched on one of my favorite subjects, which is a shipbuilding budget. And it's kind of a final question, and I'll indulge that of a little hobby of mine. But one of the problems that we run into with keeping that industrial base busy is that we saw it, especially I think the GAO report covered it real well, the cost, the per unit cost explosion with LCS, with DDG-1000, with LPD-17, and with an arguably static shipbuilding budget and looking 9 years down the road when we need to recapitalize our ballistic missile submarines. In the conversation inside the Beltway, is there an appreciation of the fact that your odds are you're not going to see a larger shipbuilding budget with the debt service we're going to have in the next decade, and some smart people need to find a way to get control of costs so the perfect don't become the enemy of the good?
No, not yet. You know, no CNO wants to be the one who backs away from 313, even though we know that current budgets can't afford that fleet. Everybody knows it, and it's really frightening because we actually need 313 as, you know, as a floor. And, you know, there really is no realistic discussion about this. And not only that, there's no acknowledgement on the government side of what the government has done wrong to promote the, you know, cost growth within programs like DDG 1000. You know, the Navy and the Pentagon made some real mistakes. And, you know, then we also don't talk about the vicious cycle of you know, reduced buy rates. The DDG 1000 started out, it was supposed to be a 32-ship buy, and then it was cut to 24, and then it was 12 to 17, then it was 7, then it was 5, then it was 3. I mean, of course it costs X billion dollars when you buy 3 as opposed to 32. And, you know, that's the kind of acquisition reform Washington doesn't talk about. You know, they just add more layers and more bureaucracy and more red tape as opposed to saying, what is the government's role in all this? You know, why do we, are they coming up with unrealistic buy rates? You know, did they add too many bells and whistles? Did, you know, the DDG 1000 is a perfect example where they kept reopening the requirements and adding more in. Well, then you're trying to build a Ferrari when you really just needed, you know, I don't know, whatever the next nice car up the line is. You know, it's just, it's the gold-plated standard, and then you don't want to use it, and it's too expensive, and then it becomes a poster child for things gone awry. But, you know, none of these conversations, unfortunately, are happening.
And I think that is why this conversation that we're having right now, we'll be having this more as well, because it's something that's got to be fixed, but I think we're all waiting for that right person to come along and have an adult conversation with everybody as adults. And Mackenzie, thank you very much for coming in this Sunday to talk to us. As always, it's a quick 30 minutes.
Thank you so much. Sorry for the technicality mix-up, but please have me again on soon.
Oh, we'd love to.
Thank you, Mackenzie.
Take care. Thank you.
And everybody, welcome to the bottom half of the hour. As a quick reminder for those that joined us, you're listening to Navy Mil Blog Radio Midrats. I am Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host Eagle One from the blog Eagle Speak. You can also find us over at the United States Naval Institute blog as well. Our second guest to discuss our topic today is James S. Robbins. Many of you probably know him as the author of Last in Their Class, Custer, Pickett, and the Goats of West Point. I know a lot of our listeners are avid book readers. He also has a new book coming out that we're going to Shanghai him with in a few more episodes, and we're going to talk specifically about it. I highly recommend it. I'm about a third of the way through it right now. His book is This Time We Win, Revisiting the Tet Offensive. He is also a political commenter and contributing editor at National Review Online, in addition to his editorial work over at the Washington Times. Jim, welcome back to Midroutes.
Hey, Sal. Great to be back.
So how are things on the front line and the funny farm in D.C. during this election season?
Well, you know, increasingly exciting. I keep waiting for the predicted civil war in the Republican Party, or the collapse of the Tea Party energy, or the sudden mobilization of the 2008 Obama grassroots, whatever the heck that was. And all of these things that the, you know, our crosstown competitor, the Post, keeps saying are going to happen just don't seem to be happening yet. So everything's moving the other direction, and it's just getting extremely exciting.
Yeah, the clock keeps ticking. I've often reminded of the Kevin Bacon character from Animal House as he stands in his Rocky uniform in the middle of the street yelling, "All is well, all is well." I think we're in for a very interesting 6 weeks. But speaking of the Tea Party, this was a question that we rolled Mackenzie's way. I wanted to get your angle at, because since we last talked in May about national security and the implications of the upcoming election, The big story over the summer was the growing wave of the Tea Party movement, which for all intents and purposes is a center-right slash libertarian groundswell. And I've been looking at it, trying to find what is the national security focus on average of this group of new candidates and people that are really excited and motivated for this election. And I really can't pin them down on anything, but the only thing I can come to is the secondary effect that if this groundswell results in either the House, the Senate, or both flipping control, these new candidates that come with this wave will vote for the people who do have seniority, and they'll become positions of power. And as a result of that, what might we see inside D.C. from a national security and defense point of view with regards to a change of emphasis, a change of theme? And I think obviously there's going to be a lot more friction there.
Yeah, I think friction is really what we're going to see. I wouldn't expect that the libertarian impulse is strong enough in what's going on right now to affect any kind of meaningful change. And that's even assuming that one or two houses of Congress change hands. I just don't think that that particular impulse in the movement is strong enough to have a lasting impact. But what it will do is that, and just the fact of changing hands, I think we're going to see a lot more oversight over what the Obama administration is doing, a lot more hearings, a lot more interesting hearings on topics that that would be of interest, and perhaps more contentiousness over what's going on. Now, I mean, it's not going to mean pulling out of Afghanistan tomorrow, because I don't think anybody on either side, at least in terms of leadership, is talking about something that radical. But definitely there will be more investigation into how the administration is conducting the war on terror, Muslim outreach efforts, things like that. I wouldn't be surprised if we had a hearing about the Fort Hood massacre and the subsequent investigation, and the issues like that. So that's the kind of thing that will lead to contentiousness, because it'll really be putting the Obama administration in the spotlight that it hasn't been heretofore.
Well, that raises some other issues. We've got Secretary of State Clinton off trying to make peace in the Middle East. Is that another one of those areas that would be subject to greater scrutiny, given what we've heard out of this particular president, if he becomes a much weaker force without having the majorities in Senate and House?
I doubt it. You know, the thing with Middle East peace is everybody knows it's out there. Nobody thinks it's going to happen. Presidents are pretty much obligated to take a run at it. Particularly presidents who've already been given their peace prize, you know, like our current president, for nothing. I mean, he's got to do something, right? So he's taking a stab at it. But, I mean, not much is going to come out of this. The Israelis right now have a really strong hand, and this is why they're so in favor of talks. They're going to set conditions which the Palestinians probably would never agree to. Although if they did, I think it would be great, but they probably won't. And even if they did, even if the PA did, Hamas would find a way to disrupt it, or Hezbollah would attack, you know, the Iranian surrogates who screw everything up. So, likelihood of any lasting impact from this is low, but also the likelihood of any blowback from failure is low, too, because nobody expects anything to come out of it. So it could only be a good outcome, you know? I mean, politically, also, it's not high on anybody's radar screen. Now, if it was going completely south, if the president decided that the way to approach this was to get punitive with Israel, to shun Netanyahu again, to start promoting all of the demands of the PA, to start recognizing Hamas as somehow legitimate. And if it went in that direction, yes, it would be a huge issue. But it's not going to. The administration started moving that direction a little bit in 2009. They got, you know, massive negative response from many of their supporters, particularly in the Jewish community. And so they're not going to touch that anymore. So this issue will just sort of drag along and then fade out.
Yeah, I agree. You know, looking at the Secretary of State Clinton, I kind of felt sorry for her because, you know, barring any significant catalyst to move things forward, it's just, it's a complete backwater. It's almost like she felt like she needed to go out there and do the standard kabuki dance that we do every now and then. But I just don't, you know, see anything going in that direction at all. And I think you're exactly right. The shameful treatment of the Prime Minister of Israel early on in this administration, having him join the Dalai Lama by going through the servants' interests at the White House, was, I think, the blowback that they got from that was enough that perhaps we won't see that happen again. And, you know, backing away from that swamp a bit, you know, another thing that we saw over the summer with our first major ally, the Dutch, going home in August from Afghanistan, there's again been a disconnect between what the military is talking about in Afghanistan, what the civilian administration is talking about in Afghanistan, and what you read about in the press about Afghanistan. In West Point speech last year, the president came out and put out the now infamous July 2011 deadline, and we've seen everybody from SecDef Gates to Petraeus to try to talk him into a direction where he has enough room to back out of that, but he hasn't backed out of that. And I think as a result, you've seen the public opinion on Afghanistan start to drift into the middle. Do you see anything coming down the road where we're going to have the elected civilian leadership try to step up to the front to bolster that support of the operations in Afghanistan? Because I don't see it.
I don't think so. I think that the elected leadership, do you mean in Congress, the elected leadership, or
the Obama administration?
Oh, in the executive branch. I think they're going to continue to just muddle through to the extent they can. With respect to that July 2011 deadline, I mean, that was a dumb thing to say. This administration does a lot of that in terms of setting deadlines or establishing metrics and things, but these are not friendly, you know, because if you make them, nobody cares. And then you go out and give a speech saying, hey, I met my metric, but no one really cares. And if you miss them, everybody cares. So they should really stop doing that. And they'll probably withdraw some unit in July 2011 and say, see, we started. You know, they'll do some pro forma thing to make the president look like he wasn't lying, you know, or didn't make a mistake. But it's just a joke. What they really need to do is get tougher. I mean, they have to continue with what they're doing. I think there have been some good results so far from the latest surge, if you want to call it that. I was at a function last week in which a fellow who had gone over to observe what the Marines are up to down in Helmand Province said that some of the Marine units were complaining now that they didn't have enemies to fight, because they had taken care of the Taliban issue in their particular areas of responsibility. I mean, that's a good sign, you know, when your guys are complaining that the enemy isn't showing up.
I was going to say, and that's the real shame of it, is the fact that this surge that started back in mid-08 is now reaching fruition. There are some great good news stories and progress that is taking place in Afghanistan that McKiernan, McChrystal, and Petraeus have been working so hard at. But it's almost as if nobody in the executive branch really wants to tell that story. They have other agendas that they want to push.
Oh, I agree. They don't want to tell the story. American people aren't really listening to the story. The news media don't care about the story because good news is not news. If it leads, it leads, but otherwise, forget it. And just like in Iraq, I mean, the best measure of success in Afghanistan will be a lack of headlines. Because in Iraq, once the surge got going and the Anbar awakening and other good things, it faded from the headlines. You just wouldn't read about it anywhere. But that's because we were winning. Same is true in Afghanistan. Lack of headlines is actually a good indication. And then, unfortunately, you get headlines like in the Post yesterday about some guys who may or may not have committed some war crimes. But that's really what the media wants to report. You know, some guys may have gone off the reservation and done bad things. That is a front and center spread on the Post. But the fact that we might be winning over there, defeating the Taliban, having a fairly free election, these kinds of things, not so important.
Well, that kind of foreshadows the conversation we'll have about your book, because if it doesn't fall within the Tet Offensive kind of dialogue, sometimes it doesn't get reported as much of anything. I saw an interesting video with you meeting with the president's advisor on, I hate to say, counterterrorism, but he doesn't seem to want to admit there's such thing as an armed jihadist movement. Would you like to comment on that a little bit? And where will that change if they get some more conservative folks into office?
Oh, yeah, that video. That was a meeting, an on-the-record meeting, despite what they later claimed, on-the-record meeting with the several members of our editorial board at the Washington Times, with John Brennan, the president's deputy national security advisor for counterterrorism. And he had said in a previous speech something about how jihad under certain conditions can be a beautiful thing, because if it refers to the inner struggle, you know, of a person, sort of their struggle with faith, that's the meaning of jihad we should be talking about. And I asked him if there was such a thing as a legitimate armed jihad in history. You know, has the armed aspect ever been legitimate? And he said, oh, yes, it has. And so I was trying to get him to give an example of a legitimate Islamic holy war. You know, which conquered peoples did he think Islam was necessary for? You know what I mean? And that's when he sort of stormed out of the room.
Yeah, he didn't like that question one bit.
Well, you know, we don't even understand why he came to that. They asked for the interview, so we don't even understand it. I think he thought he was just meeting with some, you know, dopey writers who don't know anything.
Or maybe he thought you were the Washington Independent. You never know.
Yeah, who knows? Maybe he thought we were the Post and he got lost. I'm not exactly sure.
Well, I thought you said that he had showed up in response to a previous editorial that he didn't like much. So what did you write then? Was that about the Fort Hood massacre thing?
He doesn't know anything. Something like that. I forget exactly. Oh, he said that we had mischaracterized earlier things he had said about jihad and some other stuff, and he wanted to come and correct the record. And so, he had said that terrorists have been victimized by social forces. And, you know, like, you grow up in a bad neighborhood or something and you become a terrorist, it's not your fault, you blame society. That kind of thing, I suppose. Now, he said that we mischaracterized his views because we said terrorists are victims of social forces. His point was that he had said victimized by social forces.
Oh, very nice.
I don't know what language we're speaking, but to me in English,
you should have just played him.
You know,
should have just played him the song, Officer... Should have just played him Officer Krupke from West Side Story. That's pretty much.
Say victimized by or victims of, I didn't take, English 501, but to me they're pretty much the same. And he said not, we argued it out, then he said dumb things about jihad, then he stormed out. So that was it.
I think what is a classic description of is the dangers of having people who are used to discussing theory in an academic setting, but not in the real world that everybody lives in 3D. There's a big difference between performing inside academia and performing in the real world where people want to cut off hands and blow up babies and things of that manner. The argument I always tell people, which is a strange thing for an evangelical to say, but people should read their Quran, read the Shuras, read their history as they see it, and then they ask questions like you ask, and you get interesting responses. But kind of shifting from terrorism for a bit to something that can be almost as scary, depending upon who takes the reins, is I don't think, Bill Cohen took over from Bill Perry as Secretary of Defense, and I think 97, 98, I could be off by a year or so. So, we're going on almost a decade and a half since we've had a no-kidding Democrat as the Secretary of Defense. And I know SecDef Gates would like to go back to Texas where he can get a decent stake at a decent price. And there's all sorts of rumors bouncing around the Beltway about who could adequately fill the shoes of SecDef Gates. Who are some of the options that we might be talking about in 2011 or early 2012 as Secretary of Defense if Secretary Gates heads back to Texas?
Michelle Flournoy, who's the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, is a name you sometimes hear because, that's the kind of billet that folks might associate with that, becoming SecDef, and she's been around the building for a long time, in previous administrations too, so that's a possibility. My favorite one is Hillary Clinton. I think that's probably not going to happen, but you hear that name more often than not. Folks say she's done such a great job at state that she should move to defense. Now, I question that premise. I mean, she hasn't blown it at state, but is that what it takes to do a great job? I don't know. So move her over to defense when Gates is leaving, which is allegedly at the end of next year. Some folks have said this might be to keep her out of the running for primary challenge to Obama in 2012. That kind of thinking, because if she took over defense, she'd be way too busy to do anything but take care of that job. So we'd have to wait and see. I don't know if she's going to make a challenge or not, but I sure as heck would not expect her to go to defense in any case. I mean, that's just taking on a really big job for no particular reason when she's doing just fine at state. And she could just continue to do fine there. I mean, it's all settled down, so why not just stay there?
Well, one of the questions I guess I should ask, since you're more political than certainly I am, but I even saw I forgot his name. Who's the guy with a tingle in his leg because of Obama?
Matthews.
Matthews. I even saw that he seems to be feeling the fire from the Tea Party movement and understanding that there's some people genuinely unhappy with what's going on in D.C. And I've also read some other things where people think there's a definite hop to the right as a result of the Tea Party. Is that your view? Is that where we're going with this stuff?
Well, just in terms of politics?
Well, politics and policies, is the country moving more conservative, and are we going to see more conservative policies down the road, and are the fights down the road going to be between the Democrats trying to save what they got during the first term of the Obama administration from the unwashed hordes and may get elected if the Tea Party holds sway?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think that most of the American people, a large proportion of those who voted for Democrats in 06 and then also for the president in 08 and Democrats generally in 08 had no idea that they would use these largest majorities in Congress in a generation and, you know, most successful Democratic candidate since LBJ to ram through the kind of hard left policies that they have. Now, they shouldn't have been surprised. I mean, this is what they said they were going to do. But I don't think people were listening clearly. They fell for, you know, hope and change and all, you know, vague stuff like that. They had no clue that these people were going to put into play all of the hardline, new left, whatever you want to call it, policies that they had been talking about for 20 years. And now that they've done it, the American people are having an incredible case of sticker shock and understanding that we're running up World War II level debt. I mean, it's just incredible. So, yeah, people need a strong dose of conservatism to keep the country from going completely under. And I think this will frame the debate for a long time. You know, 06 and 08 were really aberrations. And now the American people understand what happens when you vote based on your passion or, you know, because you're disappointed in something that went wrong or George Bush had an ineffective communication strategy or whatever you want to blame for it. Now they know there are real-world consequences to making stupid vote choices. And hopefully now there's going to be a return to sanity.
I think one of the effects that this election will have, and, you know, honestly, if the election had gone the other way, it probably would have happened as well. But I've listened to one and saw another interview recently with former UN Ambassador John Bolton, and he's very direct and straightforward, and he says, Iran's going to get a nuclear weapon, and this administration will do absolutely nothing about it. So whichever next administration comes on will need to have a serious plan on what, if anything, they're going to be able to do with it, because once Iran goes nuclear, the Sunni powers of Egypt and Saudi Arabia are not going to let that stand still. They're going to join Pakistan. And so whichever next administration that comes around could possibly see, you know, one or more of those nations nuclear armed. Is John Bolton being a little alarmist there, or do you see that as part of the future landscape that we're just going to have to learn to deal with?
Well, I subscribe to that model in general, but I don't think that Iran is going to get nuclear weapons capability because I think Israel is going to take care of it. Now, whether Israel can take care of it completely, I don't know, but they're going to give it a try. And for the very reason that you suggest, it's bad enough if Iran gets a nuclear weapon. But then if these Sunni states decide, well, we better have a nuclear weapon too, you know, Israel just can't exist surrounded by all that nuclear power. It just wouldn't work for them. So they will sooner or later take care of it. If we don't act, then they'll act, and they'll act whether or not we give them permission to act or not. I think that the United States has been trying to keep a lid on that for a long time, but, you know, with hopes that somehow our outreach, you know, our outreached hand will make a difference, or that sanctions will make a difference. But, you know, sanctions didn't make a difference to North Korea, one of the poorest countries in the world where people are eating grass to survive. It's not going to make a difference to Iran with one of the world's largest energy reserves. It's just not going to happen. So Iran will attempt to get a nuclear weapon, and Israel will prevent them to the extent it can doing it. And I think that they can prevent them through whatever means, whether they're overt, covert, or whatever. I think that they will make a full court press on it. In fact, it's already begun, and Israel will take care of it. They won't get any credit for it, but they'll take care of it.
Eagle One?
Well, what other exciting things do you foresee as coming out of these current electoral situations we have with it seemed to be a rather sharp turn to the conservative side?
Well, the main thing is once Republicans get subpoena power, and which they will get it with either one or two houses, you're going to see all kinds of interesting hearings on everything the Obama administration has done in their first 2 years. I suspect, like it or not, folks are going to see hearings on the birth certificate issue. I know some conservatives just groan when they hear about that, and others are all fired up about it. And it's the fired up people who are going to do it. I mean, there's some people in Congress who are ready to go on that, you know, is he legitimately the president question. And that'll be interesting to see what comes out of congressional requests for documentation, other things like that. What will the White House do? I mean, if nothing else, it just puts the White House in a bizarre position where they have to start claiming executive privilege or I don't know what on these matters. So that'll be fun to watch. Whether you believe it or not, you know, birther or not, it'll just be interesting to watch. And who knows what else? I mean, there's a big list of things that people are going to start issuing subpoenas on, whether it's things that czars have been doing that haven't been open to scrutiny, or where did all the TARP money go, the various bailouts, all kinds of stuff. So that's going to take up a lot of Congress's time, in addition to trying to pass legislation to unravel some of the stuff that's been done in the last 2 years. But also bearing in mind that the president will probably veto a lot of things. So it's not like Congress can just come in with a majority, Republican majority, and undo everything. They can't. The president will block it. So there's going to be a lot of maneuvering, a lot of blame game. I mean, the president's going to try to redo the Clinton playbook, which he will fail at because he's no Bill Clinton. And it's just going to be exciting.
Well, as the Chinese would say, Jim, we live in interesting times. And I look forward to talking to you again here in a few weeks where we are going to talk about your book on the Tet Offensive and down the road as other things develop. Thank you very much for coming in this Sunday.
My pleasure, guys. Have a good one.
You too.
Thanks, Jim.